This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn what's happened to Chelsea Manning, who's been jailed again, this time for refusing to cooperate with a grand jury that's trying to get Julian Assange put in prison. This is a threat to free journalism. We talk with grand jury expert attorney Michael Deutsch to learn how the government can misuse the grand jury. Musician and producer Eli Smith joins us to talk about this year's Brooklyn Folk Festival, a great gathering of artists from around the country to perpetuate what we call people's music. 15 years ago, Iraqis were tortured in Abu Ghraib. The pictures of these torture victims were all over the news media. No one has yet been held responsible. We talk today with senior litigating attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Catherine Gallagher, who filed a case against CACI, a military contractor with the U.S. government, and that case is going to trial at the end of April.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The Trump administration wants to prosecute the news organization WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange. In order to do so, they've recently jailed whistleblower Chelsea Manning, who has been in solitary confinement since March 8th of this year, and hope to squeeze her to get testimony that could be used against Assange. Prolonged solitary confinement is a form of torture. Chelsea Manning has refused to answer the questions of the government prosecutor in front of a grand jury. In 2010, Chelsea Manning, then in the Army, released documents to WikiLeaks known as the Iraq War Logs. One of them was a video showing a U.S. Apache attack helicopter killing 12 people, including two Reuters journalists, two children, and a passerby who stopped his van to rescue the wounded. She maintains that there's nothing new to be learned and that she's already given full testimony. Chelsea Manning was convicted and served 7 years of a 35-year sentence before her sentence was commuted by Barack Obama. The prosecution of WikiLeaks for accepting leaked secret documents is a threat to press freedom and would criminalize journalism. The government is trying to frame Assange, charging him with actively colluding with Manning, not just being a passive recipient of the leak. Historically, grand juries have been misused in order to suppress political dissent. We speak today with attorney Michael Deutsch, an expert on the misuse of grand juries. He's a partner in the Chicago law firm, the People's Law Office, and a former director of litigation at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's represented political activists and victims of government repression. Among his clients have been the Attica prisoners in 1971 uprising, Puerto Rican independence fighters, members of the Black Liberation Movement, grand jury resistors, and Palestinians falsely accused of terrorism. Attorney Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, what does a grand jury do?
Well, the grand jury, which was inserted into the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is supposed to decide whether someone should be held to stand trial on a capital case or what they call an infamous criminal case, which has been determined to be a felony. So you have 23 people come into a room. They're taken from the voter rolls or whoever way they choose jurors, and there's no lawyer for the witness who's called before the grand jury. The only person in there of official capacity is the U.S. attorney, and he asks the questions of witnesses one after the other and then makes a presentation why the grand jury should return an indictment. And the grand jury in 99% of the cases is a rubber stamp for the government. Basically, the grand jurors are just told what the law is. They hear some testimony and basically then are told to return an indictment. And so every federal felony case has to be returned by a grand jury unless both parties waive it and an information is returned. So, you know, most cases are, you know, today drug cases or fraud cases or money laundering cases, whatever they may be, they're returned by a grand jury with an indictment.
Yeah, I remember that famous saying from the Watergate case that a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. But in any case,
yes.
How is a person called before a grand jury?
They're called before a grand jury by a subpoena issued by the grand jury, but oftentimes the FBI has subpoenas, and they go out and serve a prospective witness and summon them before the grand jury. And most of the people that appear before the grand jury are either law enforcement or eyewitnesses to crime. And they're just occurrence witnesses who testify what they saw or what they knew. But we've also developed, since World War II and particularly since the 60s, what I would call as an investigative grand jury, which is a grand jury which is seeking information about the political associations of someone they call before the grand jury to kind of gather information about political activity of others. And this is a way that they can force people to give information about someone in their community or someone in a political organization that they're involved with or someone who they know who has certain political ideals.
So a person is subpoenaed. They're sitting in front of the grand jury. The prosecutor's questioning them. What happens if the person that's called before the grand jury testifies that she just can't remember?
Well, I mean, if you know, that could be subject to questioning about whether the person really can't remember or is basically trying to hide information. And if the U.S. attorney feels the person's not being honest and really can remember, but saying they can't remember, then they could go before a judge and ask the judge to order the person to answer the question and not accept their answer that they can't remember.
But what happens if a person lies to the grand jury?
Well, first of all, you know, you have a Fifth Amendment right not to testify in a grand jury if you can show that your testimony theoretically could incriminate you. And what happens often, and particularly in these investigative grand juries against political activists, is they offer them what's called use immunity, which means that they cannot use what they testify before the grand jury against this person, this witness that's appearing. And that strips them of their Fifth Amendment right, and therefore they have to testify or they can be held in contempt, because the theory is that if we're not going to use your testimony against you, then it won't incriminate you. Now, some states and the federal system used to have what's called transactional immunity, which meant that any crime you testify about cannot be ever you can never be charged with it. So it's not just you're using your testimony against you, but it cannot use any crime that the grand jury's investigating that you testify about against you, not even beyond what using your own testimony. Now, you ask me what happens if a person lies before the grand jury. Even if you have immunity or you don't have immunity, if you lie before the grand jury, that's a felony, and you can be charged with perjury.
So what happens if you refuse to testify, the prosecutor gets you a grant of immunity, and you still refuse to testify? Then what happens?
Well, you have what's called a hearing for contempt, and you can raise certain claims, constitutional claims that say that even though you've been given immunity, you shouldn't be forced to testify because the subpoena was the product of illegal activity. So one claim that's raised is that I've been illegally surveilled or wiretapped, and that's where you got the information to call me for the grand jury, and therefore it's a violation of my Fourth Amendment right. Or you could argue that the grand jury is illegal because it's investigating First Amendment protected activity, and therefore, even if I have immunity, I should not be forced to comply with that type of grand jury investigation. And kind of that's, you know, we'll get into it later, but that's what Chelsea Manning's position has been, even though he was given immunity. But oftentimes, almost always, all the legal challenges of the grand jury, even challenging the composure of the grand jury, whether there's, you know, racial discrimination in how the grand jurors are chosen, are unsuccessful. And ultimately, the strategy has been to try and raise as many legal issues as you can to delay the ultimate end of going to jail for criminal or for civil contempt. Because civil contempt is measured by the life of the grand jury. Grand juries sit for 18 months. So if the grand jury has already been sitting, or you can delay the contempt, then you delay the amount of time you've been in jail. So if the grand jury's been sitting for 6 months, and you can, your legal challenges could take up another 3 or 4 months, then you only have to do 8 months in contempt. Now, there's also a thing which says, since there's two types of contempt, civil contempt and criminal contempt. Civil contempt, as I said, is for the life of the grand jury. Sometimes what the theory is that you hold the keys to your own freedom. So as soon as you testify, then we'll let you out of jail. And there's a thing which has been commonly called, which is a grumbles motion, which is a motion you make after your client's been sitting in jail for 3 months or 4 months, or sometimes even before they go to jail, saying, my client will never testify before this grand jury. So civil contempt is of no use. You can never force him to testify. So therefore, you should let him out of jail or not put him in jail. And that's been successful in some cases where people have done months in contempt, and then the judge says, well, I can see this is not going to work, so I'm going to let you out.
Yeah, I remember Bernadine Dorn was freed on that basis. I remember she was in jail here in New York City. She had a couple of children. She was taken out of her home, separated from her children. As a matter of principle, she refused to cooperate with them. And finally, her lawyer was able to convince the judge that she would never cooperate, and they let her go.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about this, Michael Deutsch. Why is a grand jury a political tool? Talk about the extraordinary governmental power and prosecutorial misconduct of using a grand jury to force political activists to testify at secret proceedings or to be imprisoned without specific criminal charges or a trial.
I refer to it as a form of political internment U.S. style, because you're not charged with a crime, you don't have a trial in front of a jury. And oftentimes the government knows, particularly if they focus on political activists, they're not going to cooperate with the grand jury. So this is a way that they can put them in jail for contempt without having to charge them with a crime. So it's a tremendous power, because the grand jury, through the U.S. attorney, it's all run through the U.S. attorney. Mostly the grand jury doesn't do anything but sit there and absorb what the questions and answers are, and then told what the indictment should be. The U.S. attorney has the power to pick out people who are political activists, who they know will not become informants against their movement, and who ascribe to a position of non-collaboration with the grand jury, and intern them by giving them a grand jury subpoena, and then, you know, taking away their Fifth Amendment rights by giving them immunity. So it's a tremendous power, and it has always been used by the government. I mean, there's this theory that the grand jury is supposed to protect you, stand between you and the government, so you don't have to stand trial in a case unless the grand jury says there's probable cause to make you go forward. But the reality is, even back in England, where the grand jury began, the grand jury always did the bidding of the government or the popular movement of people who were supporting the government. And our history in the U.S. has always been all these people, political people, have been indicted from the, you know, beginning of this country with the Alien and Sedition Acts, the labor movement, you know, thousands of IWW people indicted by grand juries in the civil, in the slavery, in the North, the grand jury protected people who were fleeing, but in the South they were used against, you know, people who were organizing against slavery. And Reconstruction, again, grand juries were used throughout our history. But what happened a lot was it wasn't always clear that the Fifth Amendment was limited to protect you against the words you use. In other words, use immunity. And what it said before was that you can be incriminated by having to tell the grand jury about your personal activities, your political associations, and that was a form of incrimination. And therefore, even if they gave you immunity, if the immunity wouldn't cover that. But slowly the Supreme Court decided that use immunity was sufficient, that there was no other than protected from a crime, you could be brought before the grand jury. And then in the 60s with the Nixon administration, they began to go after the anti-war movement with grand juries, and they had grand juries sitting all over the country subpoenaing anti-war activists and people from the women's movement and from the Black Liberation Movement. There's this guy called Guy Goodwin, who was the head of the Internal Securities Division of the Justice Department, and they were just running these grand juries, bringing people in and forcing them to either cooperate or go to jail. So that was the beginning of the push of the use of the grand jury as a political, conscious political tool to invade the political associations of people who were active opposing government policies.
We're speaking with Attorney Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office. Michael's handled a lot of grand jury cases in his long legal career. Michael, you've convinced me that the constitutional principles of due process, presumption of innocence, trial by jury, are all violated by the misuse of the grand jury. Let's talk now about what the grand jury, what the government behind it really is trying to do by trying to get testimony from Chelsea Manning. She's now in prison because she won't cooperate. What kind of situation is Chelsea Manning?
Well,
in now?
It's unique in my experience in some ways, because here's somebody that got 35 year sentence, did 7 years, was pardoned in the legal process before she went to prison. She pretty much said what she did. She had this information. It was shocking to her. It was about gross government, you know, murder and misconduct in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she tried to give it to the New York, Washington Post and the New York Times, and they wouldn't take it. So then she gave it to WikiLeaks, and for that she went to prison. Now she's been out of prison, and all of a sudden they're going to bring her before a grand jury, allegedly, apparently, investigating this Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. But we've been told, and it's been leaked inadvertently, that they already have an indictment against Julian Assange. And the law is pretty clear, although there are exceptions, that you can't use a grand jury to investigate an indictment that you've already returned. Okay? Even though it's not public, they have an indictment. So you can't call people to the grand jury to gather evidence to help build for trial. That's not appropriate. Once a grand jury indictment is returned, then you can't subpoena someone to get more information for a trial. And Chelsea Manning's position, which I admire greatly, is saying, I'm not going to be part of a process that's going to criminalize WikiLeaks, who is doing an incredibly important First Amendment right of disseminating whistleblowing information that is critical to our knowledge of how the U.S. conducts its war policy. And the danger of this is significant, because if Julian Assange is indicted for disseminating this information that he got from a whistleblower, assuming a Chelsea Manning, it's going to strike a death blow to investigative journalism who get classified information, who many from the New York Times, the Straight Media, from Washington Post, get information that's classified and they publish it. I mean, that was the whole Pentagon Papers, and the Supreme Court basically said they had a right to do it, or they couldn't enjoin them for doing it. So this is a threat, basically, to all whistleblowers and people who are trying to exercise their freedom of the press to, you know, disseminate this information that's critical to our knowledge about how the government operates.
And Chelsea Manning has said, I've already told them everything I know. There's nothing
Absolutely.
More I can tell them.
What more could they need from her?
Yeah.
You know, it just seems that I can't imagine why they would subpoena her. They have her under oath at her plea hearing or her sentencing hearing saying what she did, you know? So they want to make her somehow part of this case against Julian Assange. And she is standing up for political principles, you know, at the cost of being back in prison. Wow. So I admire what she's done, and I think it's an important thing. And it's interesting because I just read a piece by this guy Goodall, who is a lawyer for I think the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers, and he was blasting the straight media for not supporting her and not really supporting Assange as well, and not saying this guy has a right. He is a journalist. He is putting out information that's critical, important to the American people. And why aren't these, you know, media people supporting him and supporting her?
Yeah, I read the same piece. Very scary. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says that Julian Assange is operating what he calls a non-state intelligence service. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Mike Pompeo is a fascist to his core, and he's just trying to suppress information about how our war policy is, you know, abhorrent and illegal and unconstitutional, and how we've killed civilians at will and, you know, covered it up and, you know, I don't think he's worthy even the time, you know, to consider it. But one thing I did want to get into was this idea of criminal contempt, which is I've experienced that in several of my cases. Which is, as I said, you can be held in civil contempt, and that's for the life of the grand jury. But they also have what's called criminal contempt, which is a crime which has no maximum sentence. So theoretically, you can be sentenced up to life in prison for criminal contempt. And it's the same act. You can be cited for civil contempt and be doing time in the jail for civil contempt, and they can then indict you for criminal contempt and make you stand a trial in a criminal case. And one of the cases I was recently involved in was a Palestinian man named Abdel Halim Ashgar, who was cited for civil contempt in New York. He did, I don't know, 8 months in jail for civil contempt because they were trying to link him to funding for Hamas and funding for people living under occupation. He ran for president of the PA in 2006, and he's got a doctor in business administration. He's a very learned guy. And the judge in New York, after this period of time, 8 months, said, oh, I'm going to let him out because I don't see how the grand jury's going to, you know, get their information. It's basically said they can't be coerced. So then he was about to leave the country because he couldn't get political asylum. And a week before he was going to leave, they subpoenaed him to a grand jury in Chicago. And now they already knew he wasn't going to testify, and they subpoenaed him to a grand jury in Chicago, and he didn't testify. They put him in jail. He's in there for 3 or 4 months, and then they indict him with a client of mine by the name of Mohammed Salah, and one of the charges in his indictment is criminal contempt for refusing to testify in the grand jury. So, and they also charge him and my client with a RICO conspiracy to be part of a racketeering influenced organization, Hamas. In other words, they were saying Hamas was like a racketeering organization, which was, you know, unprecedented. And they were acquitted of those charges, okay? Of all charging having to do with terrorism or funding terrorism, both were acquitted after a long trial. But, of course, Dr. Asghar didn't testify in the grand jury, so the instruction was, did he testify or didn't he testify? And they convicted him of criminal contempt. And the government basically asked for 20 years to put him in prison for 20 years for this act of civil disobedience, basically saying that by not testifying in front of a grand jury that was investigating the funding of Hamas, he was in effect alluding to or part of this conspiracy, and therefore he should be sentenced based on his involvement in terrorism, like the terrorism enhancement clause of the sentencing guidelines. The judge, who was trying to be, you know, less than oppressive, gave him 11 and a half years. Wow. 11 and a half years, which I've never heard of a sentence like that for contempt for not testifying in the grand jury. And he just got out of prison, maybe, this happened in 2006, and he just got out of prison like several months ago. Yes. And now they want to deport him.
That's just an awful story, a very scary story. Michael, we're running out of our allotted time here, but I just wanted to emphasize a couple of things. Chelsea Manning is in solitary confinement, and I have the address that people can write to her, and I'm going to, at the end of our interview, give people her address so they can show her some moral support. And you'll remember when she was in prison the last time for 7 years, she did a lot of time in solitary confinement and actually attempted suicide twice. So it's a real death threat that they've done to her. And the other death threat that I'm worried about is there's the sealed indictment against Assange. If the government succeeds in bringing him back to the United States and he's tried here, we don't know what he's going to be tried for, but it's a possibility they could go for the death penalty against Assange too, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I know he'll probably get indicted under the Espionage Act, so that's a very serious charge. I'm not sure if it allows for the death penalty unless you can show somebody died as a result, you know, that you're responsible for. Otherwise, I think it would be unconstitutional. But it's a very serious charges he's facing. And it would really destroy news people getting classified information and shut down all these whistleblowers who are trying to get out this information about how our government acts. So I think Chelsea Manning is a hero, as Daniel Ellsberg has said, and I also think that people, including the media, should be supporting her release.
If our listeners can get a pen, I'm going to give you Chelsea Manning's address and encourage you to write to her and show your support. Chelsea Manning, A0181426, William G. Truesdale, Adult Detention Center, 2001 Mill Road, Alexandria, Virginia, 22314. And we'll post that on our website at lawanddisorder.org. Michael Deutsch, very gratified to be able to reach you out there in California and speak with you about this. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, my pleasure, Mike. Thanks for all of your good work.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Political radicalizations and social upheavals in the USA in the 30s and then again in the 1960s, we saw an increased interest in folk music. This phenomena is repeating itself today.
We speak with Eli Smith, the producer of the Brooklyn Folk Festival. He's a banjo player, a folklorist, and a member of the string band The Downhill Strugglers. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is the largest of its type in the country and is now in its 11th year. It takes place in Brooklyn Heights at the historic St. Anne's Church on April 5th, 6th, and 7th. Eli Smith, welcome back to Law and Disorder. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Eli, let's start with something basic. I mean, what's folk music?
Well, I think one of the wonderful things about folk music is that it means different things to different people, and it's something that people really hold dear to themselves. For me, and at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, folk music is something that's very diverse and represents music that comes from a place that's not a corporate place. That's a humanistic, people-centered place that has a deep history. It's sort of the people's history of music.
Why did you start the Brooklyn Folk Festival?
Well, I was surprised that there wasn't already a Brooklyn Folk Festival. I thought of the idea in 2008, and we had our first festival in 2009. And I started the festival because there was such a rich scene for folk music, for traditional music, old music, music that comes out of communities and goes back, in many cases, hundreds or thousands of years. Music that's very well adapted to the needs of people, as I say, music that's been created over generations. Why do we need music? Why is it so important to us? It's because it satisfies certain emotional and psychological needs that we have as humans. And I started the festival to make a yearly focus here in New York City for the wonderful folk music scene that we have here in town, but then it's really grown to be a place that our whole community of musicians from around the United States can come, musicians that are largely overlooked by festivals that are more hooked into, you know, the music industrial complex or whatever.
What's the lineage here? Are there previous eras, cultural workers, and festivals that you look to for inspiration?
Oh, yes. It was always my hope and goal growing up here in New York City to make an alliance with and, you know, meet the folks that had made the folk music scene of the 1950s and 60s that many people that are interested in the music look back to, Bob Dylan being the most well-known person that came out of that. But if you look into it, it was really a place where some powerful artists and musicians were, cultural workers, you know, were working. So I look back to their work with the early years of the Newport Folk Festival and the University of Chicago Folk Festival, among others, as a model for the Brooklyn Folk Festival, and try to, you know, give people with our festival a real folk festival experience. You know, you see something that's called a folk music festival. Maybe you're interested by that and you want to come down and check it out. And then you get there and it's, you know, a festival that is pretty much just dedicated to singer-songwriters, or is more of like an Americana or sort of indie rock, indie folk festival. Those are all fine, and we do present some great songwriters at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, but my hope is to present something that's much more diverse and rooted in traditional music and music that comes historically out of communities.
What do you recommend to people at the festival this year? What's going to be happening that people can look forward to?
Well, at the festival this year, we'll have blues music, jug band, old-time string bands, Afro-Colombian music, music from Sardinia and from Mali in West Africa. We'll be having some, as I say, some great songwriters, old-school jazz, sacred steel music. I don't know if people have heard of sacred steel. That's a wonderful tradition within the African-American church of gospel music played using lap and pedal steel guitars. Just phenomenal. We'll have that on Saturday night. We'll have ragtime music. We have so much music at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. There's nearly 50 different bands, as well as film premieres, workshops if you want to learn how to play an instrument or sing, jam sessions, and, of course, our yearly absurd contest, the banjo toss, the banjo throwing competition. We see who can throw a banjo the farthest into the Gowanus Canal, and whoever wins in the men's and or women's category will receive a free banjo, and not the one that you threw into the fetid canal.
Well, I've been at the banjo throwing contest. I remember when somebody from Kansas City won it a couple years ago. The guy was a shot putter.
He's a high school shot put champion. That's right.
Amazing. And I remember the person that was the banjo was on a rope, and the guy that was retrieving the banjo after every toss had to wear rubber gloves because the Gowanus Canal is a Superfund site.
Yeah, at Harper's Disease. It's totally fine, and we do provide rubber gloves. The banjo toss is a whole lot of fun. You can look up all this stuff on the internet. I would also add that May 3rd would be Pete Seeger's 100th birthday, and at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, we are having a 100th birthday Pete Seeger commemoration, and it's a children's and family music, you know, sing-along. Pete Seeger kind of invented the modern concept of kids' music among his many other amazing contributions to American culture. So if you have kids or anything, yeah, and you want to come down and sing with us, please consider that as well.
That's April 5th, 6th, and 7th at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. What is it, brooklynfolkfest.com?
Yeah, the website is brooklynfolkfest.com, and the festival, I produce the festival. The festival is presented by the Jalopy Theater and School of Music, where I work, which is the home for folk music in New York City at this moment in history.
I see on the card that you're passing out here that the Downhill Strugglers, which is your band, is playing with John Cone. Tell us a little bit about the Strugglers and about John Cone.
Oh, sure. Well, of course, I have my own string band booked in there somewhere. The Downhill Strugglers.
Was it a hard gig to get?
Yeah, it was in a way. Yeah, we're an old-time string band. I mostly play banjo in that band. We've been around for about 7 years. You know, we play banjo and fiddle music, songs and ballads, you know, old-time rural American music. Everybody can check us out, the Downhill Strugglers. Look us up. We have a few albums out, including one on Jalopy's own record label, Jalopy Records. And we'll be playing with John Cone, who is our friend and our teacher. He had a band for 50 years called the New Lost City Ramblers. They were kind of the great string band that came out of the folk revival of the 1950s.
I remember John Cone telling me that he had accompanied Woody Guthrie to sing some songs in Washington Square Park in the late 50s. So John goes all the way back.
Yes, he does. John goes all the way back even into the 40s. I mean, he saw the Leadbelly Memorial Concert in 1948 featuring Woody Guthrie and stuff. Bob Dylan is famously known for having visited Woody Guthrie in the hospital when he was sick at the end of his life. But that was something that people did back then that were a core part of the folk music scene in New York City. Was kind of visit and take care of Woody Guthrie. John Cone did that, as well as Ralph Rinsler and other people that were part of that scene. And the folk music scene in New York, you know, Leadbelly moved to New York City in 1935. Pete Seeger returned here in 1939. Woody Guthrie arrived in early 1940. Margot Mayo, the great, you know, square dance leader and folklorist was already here, and they were working, you know, since the late 30s or early 40s, and they worked for 20 years before the so-called folk boom of the early 1960s. It was a lot of really, as I say, great cultural workers working a long time to make that happen.
Eli, I see that you've brought some music along to give people a taste for what's going to happen at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. Please share some of that with us.
Well, I'd actually like to play a track from one of the bands that's coming from far away to be at the festival this year. Great string band from Western Arkansas that's coming this year called the Ozark Highballers. They're a great old-time string band from outside of Fayetteville, Arkansas. Let's hear the song off their new album on Jalopy Records. This is one called Kenny Wagner's Surrender. It's a great ballad. Check out the words.
After you heard my story in the Kenny Wagner song, now down in Mississippi, I took the road that's wrong. It was down in Mississippi where I murdered my first man, when the sheriff there at Leakesville for justice took his stand. state of Tennessee. Two men went down before me, and I took my liberty. I wandered through the country, but never did find rest, till I got to Texarkana, way out in the west.
Eli, the Ozark Highballers are great. I've got the album. Thanks for bringing the songs along. Play us another one, will you please?
Sure thing. Well, one of our mainstays at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, as you well know, is Jerron Paxton, Jerron Blind Boy Paxton, amazing blues, a ragtime folk musician. Why don't we hear a live recording from him from a few years ago at the Brooklyn Folk Festival? Here's Jerron Blind Boy Paxton with the Catfish Blues. Here's the Catfish Blues.
Well, I wish I was a catfish, swimming way down in the deep blue sea. I'd have all these good-looking women, Lord, fishing after me, fishing after me, Lord, fishing after me. While I went to my baby's house, and I sat down on her step, she said, "Come on in, Daddy, my husband just..."
Now we're talking with Eli Smith, the producer of the Brooklyn Folk Festival, which is coming up next weekend, April 5th, 6th, and 7th, at the historic St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. And you can look it up at brooklynfolkfest.com. Eli, we're running out of our allotted time here, but before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about the historic link between folk music and progressive politics in the United States. Why is that? Talk about that, please.
Yeah, well, that is a historic connection here in the United States, and an important one that's been approached in different ways. Initially, folk music was known as people's music, and that was an important thing that was thought of during the Popular Front era, but in a way it was one-dimensional, and that's an idea that's been expanded over the years. Folk music encompasses political songs, topical songs, you know, that deal specifically with events in the movement, issues in social movements, but in my mind it's even deeper than that. It's music that's actually important to people during times of you know, crisis, of social crisis, like war and economic recession and so on. And we've actually seen that manifested historically. In the 1930s, there was a movement towards, you know, an idea of folk music. It happened again in the 1960s, times of great political turmoil. And, you know, I think, and it's happening again now. People that are alienated and their needs aren't being met by the corporate and the capitalist entertainment industrial complex look for something that they perceive as more authentic. Authentic is a loaded word, but it's, you know, something that, but it is a real word and a real idea of something that is meaningful. People look for meaning. And in the old historic forms of human music, there's a lot of meaning and a lot of feeling and a lot of soul. Just a great diversity of style. The music that you hear on the radio is very, very narrow. You won't hear much diversity at all on the radio. But when you start to look into folk music and traditional music, not just from the United States but from all around the world, you find the real depth of what music can be about. And that's what we try to put forward at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. Tickets are very reasonably priced, and I hope you all will come. So please do check it out.
Yeah, it's brooklynfolkfest.com. Eli, I see that you're going to have jam sessions, film screenings, a square dance, workshops, a puppet show, a New Orleans dance party, the banjo toss, of course, music for children, and delicious local food. And you've been organizing this. How long did what's involved in organizing an extravaganza like this? How long does it take? What do you do?
Yeah. I work on it all year. In fact, I'm already planning the 2020 festival. But yeah, you know, it is a big job to organize an event like that. But this is our 11th year of the festival, And I think we've really hit our stride.
You brought along another one, not an American one. Talk about that for a second and play it for us, will you please?
Well, here's a short one from a great band that'll be at the Brooklyn Folk Festival this year, the Ukrainian Village Voices band, wonderful vocal group singing music from rural Ukraine. And here's a song which translates in English as Our Village. It's quite short, beautiful song on their album that's out on Jalopy Records.
In 2016, the United States Appeals Court reinstituted the Abu Ghraib prison abuse case against a private military contractor, Khaki. Since that time, the plaintiffs have had multiple victories. The Center for Constitutional Rights is representing the abused prisoners. CCR's legal director, Bahir Azmi, said, "There's no question that torture is unlawful under domestic, military, and international law. The only issue in this case is whether Khaki will be held accountable or treated with impunity for its role in torture in Abu Ghraib." The case is now set for trial in Alexandria, Virginia, on April 23rd. We speak today with CCR senior attorney Catherine Gallagher, who filed the case nearly 11 years ago. Catherine Gallagher works on universal jurisdiction and international criminal law cases involving U.S. and foreign officials and torture and other war crimes and cases involving private military corporations and torture at Abu Ghraib. Katie Gallagher, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, this is a really important case. Tell us about who are the plaintiffs and tell us about them and what happened to them.
Sure. This case is actually the third in a series of cases brought by torture survivors of Abu Ghraib. The three clients in this, the last remaining case, are Saleh El-Ajali, Suhail El-Shamari, and Assad El-Zubai. And these are three Iraqi civilians who were detained at the hard site of Abu Ghraib back in 2003-2004. And the hard site is that place that your listeners may remember from the notorious photos that came out around Abu Ghraib about 15 years ago this coming month. So these are three Iraqis who were living their lives, found themselves picked up and detained, never charged, and during the time that they were detained, subjected to acts of cruel treatment, inhumane and degrading treatment, and treatment ultimately rising to the level of torture. And for the last 11 years, despite having been detained and mistreated at the hands of Americans, they have turned to American courts to pursue their claims for some measure of justice.
What facts are you seeking to prove at the trial?
Well, this is a case brought against a private contractor, a government contractor called Khaki, CACI, Premier Technology, which was hired by the United States and ultimately given the task to provide interrogators and other personnel at the Abu Ghraib hard site. So what we are alleging in this case is that the Khaki interrogators conspired with certain military officers and military personnel, including the MPs, the military police, who were court-martialed many years ago, in a conspiracy to torture the detainees. And what we're alleging is that in a situation of a command vacuum at Abu Ghraib, these private military contractors assumed a level of authority as interrogators and gave instructions and otherwise encouraged MPs to, quote, soften up detainees and mistreat them, particularly at night in the hard site, so that when detainees came in for interrogation, they were softened up and ready to talk. In this case, our you know, our clients, again, had no information to give, which meant that this mistreatment went on again and again for them over a period of time.
So talk about the defendants. So what has been their defense or defenses that they've raised over the years?
Well, it's been 11 years. It's been a very long-running case with many ups and downs. And they have really kind of raised a number of legal defenses, but in essence, it boils down to a theory that, look, we didn't do anything wrong to these plaintiffs, and to the extent anything wrong was done to these plaintiffs, those acts were ultimately authorized by the government, and we were working with the government, and so we should be protected from liability because of our relationship as government contractors working, doing interrogations hired by the U.S. government. So they've put a number of different labels on this, whether it's political question or derivative immunity or other kinds of defenses to essentially say you can't hold us liable because we were working with the government.
So what issues does the case raise?
I think the case raises a number of kind of large issues. One is about access to justice. As I mentioned, it's been 11 years in running. We have a trial date set for April 23rd. Our plaintiffs have been willing to continue to go through this case because they believe that they deserve to have their day in court and want to have that day in court in a U.S. court against a U.S. company. So that, just how difficult it is to actually have these claims heard is one piece. This is about ending impunity for torture and accountability for torture. When we're talking about the most serious crimes, there should be some level of accountability, and that is something that the U.S. has committed itself to as a signatory to the Convention Against Torture. This case also raises some of the flags, the red flags, of use of private companies who maybe are motivated by different things than a government official. You know, this is a publicly traded company who was hired, so there is a question of this being business, interrogation being business, that is surfaced in this case, and whether there are certain functions that it's better to leave to government officials who have responsibilities by virtue of being public officials to not only the citizenry, but those who they are coming in contact with. So I think there are a number of issues, and of course it just raises some of the historical issues of what happened in Iraq in the aftermath of the U.S. occupation, you know, and whether corporations can be held liable for international human rights violations. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is a case brought by three men, and it is their case, and it's their opportunity to have their story heard and understood.
11 years. Why has it taken so long?
Because we've been up and down to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. You know, I think I'm the only lawyer who's been on the case. I am the only lawyer who's been on the case through these 11 years. And we filed at the end of May 2008. We won our motion to dismiss in March 2009. And, you know, at that point, thought we're heading to trial. And instead, we went into a protracted appeals process that took 3 years. And then we were back to the Fourth Circuit again and again based on these different defenses that CACI has tried to raise. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't say that a defendant shouldn't be able to raise defenses and vigorously, you know, advocate for themselves. But this has really gone on for far too long with a repackaging of some of the same arguments again and again. And I think that the time is for now that our plaintiffs have their day in court. CACI has filed another notice of appeal out of a decision that came down last Friday, but we hope that our plaintiffs will indeed be able to tell their story to a U.S. jury in Alexandria on April 23rd.
Are the plaintiffs actually going to be here in the United States for the trial?
We have been trying to get the plaintiffs to the U.S. At this point, they have not yet been admitted to the U.S., so we are making contingency plans for a video link testimony, but at least they will be speaking directly to a U.S. jury, even if not in person. But of course, we do hope that they are able to tell their story in person.
So you're on the trial team. Who do you have along with you?
Bahar Azmi, who is our legal director, has been on the case for many, many years now. It's been so long running, so he has been deep into this and litigating this with me. And then we are working with a law firm, Pedersen Belknap, and another firm, Akil Valentine's. But it's a pretty small team, so we will look forward to getting ready for trial.
What are you doing to prepare for the trial?
There's still quite an active motion practice, so a lot of filings back and forth and just trying to get our evidence in order and prepared to be able to present our case.
Well, Katie Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights, my deepest appreciation for your 11-year effort on this. I know you've got to run to do some more work, but before I let you go, might I please, on a personal note, ask you how you got involved in this kind of legal work?
That's a bit of a long story, but you know, I've been lucky to have some mentors along the way who have brought me to CCR. You know, Rhonda Copeland had been my professor at CUNY Law School, and I've had the true privilege to work through the years, first with Michael Ratner, and I should note that Michael was very instrumental in bringing the initial case against private military contractors, the Saul Levy Titan case, and then Peter Weiss, a longtime contributor to the work of CCR. So coming to understand what role lawyers can play in pushing for positive social change and bringing the world more into the way we want it to be in terms of equality and dignity, that is something, you know, that there have been a lot of people leading the way, including from CCR over the years. So I feel very lucky to be here.
You're really what we call in the studio here, a lawyer you'll like. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Success on your case. We'll be checking in with you because we want to interview once you win this case. Good luck to you, and you take it easy.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.